Welcome to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Lipsack. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source grassroots community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of this show is Life and Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. This show provides practical, general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. It's good to have some notebook, paper, and pen to take notes during the show. Over the last several months, I have been investigating into the whole issue of what is known as the web of debt. We have been using a book called The Web of Debt by Ellen Brown, who's an attorney, to try to understand what is really perceived as the shocking truth about our money system, and of course, ultimately, how we can break free. In short, our money system is not what we have been led to believe. The creation of money has been privatized or taken over by a private money cartel. Except for coins, all of our money is now created as loans advanced by private banking institutions, including the private Federal Reserve. Banks create the principal, but not the interest, to service their loans. To find the interest, new loans must continually be taken out, expanding the money supply, inflating prices, and robbing you of the value of your money. The Web of Debt is a book that unravels this deception and presents a crystal clear picture of the financial abyss towards which we are all heading. It then, in a positive vein, explores workable alternatives, one in particular that was tested in colonial America and is grounded in the best of American economic thought, including the writings of Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, and Abraham Lincoln. It's a very important and ultimately practical presentation of what money is all about, and of course then how to deal with it for our own financial security, for that of the nation, and ultimately the entire globe. At the onset, I'd like to give an important credit because the thoughts, ideas, and examples used in this program are directly from or based on the work, theories, and books of attorney, scholar, and author Ellen Brown, who has 11 other books and scores of articles in the area of debt. I highly recommend that you actually read her book, The Web of Debt. You can also go to her website by the same name, and you can review all of the shows that we have produced for debt-related issues at the archives, www.kruufm.com, under Life and Debt, and specifically on this topic, Life and Debt Web. Now let's continue from where we left off in the last show with a little recap. We started out investigating the Great Depression. That, of course, is the stock market which crashed in 1929. When that happened, it precipitated a worldwide depression that lasted for a decade. Probably not very many people experienced it who are still alive today, but we can still get the flavor of it through the movies. The Great Depression was depicted in the barren black and white Kansas drought opening the 1939 film The Wizard of Oz, and it was also the setting for It's a Wonderful Life, which is a classic 1946 film that starred Jimmy Stewart as a beloved small town banker named George Bailey, who was driven to consider suicide after a run on his bank when the townspeople all demanded their money and he couldn't pay. The relevant point here is that the promise of the Federal Reserve Act that it would prevent panics by allowing a conglomeration of big banks to come to the rescue of little banks that got caught shorthanded had obviously failed. The crash of 1929 was the biggest bank run in history. This problem began in the roaring 20s when the Fed made money plentiful by keeping interest rates low. Money seemed to be plentiful, but what was actually flowing freely was credit or debt. Production was up more than wages were up, so more goods were available than money to pay for them, but people could borrow. By the end of the 1920s, major consumer purchases such as cars and radios were bought mainly on credit. Money was so easy to get that people were borrowing just to invest, taking out short-term low-interest loans that were readily available from the banks. Unlike today, at that time the stock market held little interest for most people, but then the robber barons started promoting it after amassing large stock holdings very cheaply themselves. They sold the public on the idea that it was possible to get rich quick by buying stock on margin, which means on credit. The investor could put down a part payment, that is a down payment, on the stock and pay off the balance after its price went up, reaping a hefty profit. That was the theory. But this investment strategy turned the stock market into a speculative pyramid scheme, just like it is today, in which most of the money invested did not actually exist. People would open margin accounts, not because they could not afford to pay 100% of the stock price, but because it allowed them to leverage their investments, buying 10 times as much stock by paying only a 10% down payment. And again, leveraging means buying securities with borrowed money. In general, the public went absolutely wild over this scheme. In a speculative fever, many people literally bet everything they had, the house, the farm, life insurance, and anything to get money to get into the market and, in hopes, make more money. Homesteads that had been owned free and clear were mortgaged to the bankers, who fanned the fever by offering favorable credit terms and interest rates. The Federal Reserve made these favorable terms possible by substantially lowering the rediscount rate, that is the interest rate member banks paid to borrow from the Fed. The Fed thus made it very easy for banks to acquire additional reserves against which they could expand the money supply by many multiples with loans. But that raises the question, why would the Fed want to flood the U.S. economy with borrowed money, inflating the money supply? The evidence points to a scheme between Benjamin Strong, then governor of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, and Montague Norman, head of the Bank of England, to deliver control of the financial systems of the world to a small group of private central bankers. Strong was a Morgan man who had a very close relationship with Norman, so close that it was evidently more than just business. In 1928, when Strong had to retire due to illness, Norman wrote intimately, quote, "Whatever is to happen to us, wherever you and I are to live, we cannot now separate and ignore these years. Somehow, we must meet, and sometimes we must live together." End of quote. Professor Carol Quigley wrote of Norman and Strong, quote, "In the 1920s, they were determined to use the financial power of Britain and of the United States to force all the major countries of the world to go on the gold standard and to operate it through central banks, free from all political control, with all questions of international finance to be settled by agreements by such central banks without interference from governments." End of quote. If you are just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you are listening to Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from CRU LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Now back to Norman and Strong. Norman, as the head of the Bank of England, was determined to keep the British pound convertible to gold at pre-war levels, although the pound had lost substantial value as against gold during World War I. The result was a major drain on British gold reserves. To keep gold from flowing out of England into the United States, the Federal Reserve, led by Strong, supported the Bank of England by keeping U.S. interest rates low, which inflates the U.S. dollar. The higher interest rates in London made it more attractive for investors to place their gold there, drawing it from the United States to England, but the lower rates in the United States caused an inflation bubble, which soon got out of hand. The meetings between Norman and Strong were very secretive, but the evidence suggests that in February of 1929, they concluded that a collapse in the market was inevitable and that the best course was to let it correct naturally. Naturally, that is, with a little help from the Fed. They sent advisory warnings to lists of preferred customers, including wealthy industrialists, politicians, and high foreign officials, telling them to get out of the market. Then, the Fed began selling government securities in the open market, reducing the money supply by reducing the reserves available for backing loans. The bank loan rate was also increased, causing rates on brokers' loans to jump to 20%. So what was the result of all of this? It was a huge liquidity squeeze, a lack of available money. Short-term loans suddenly became available only at a much higher interest rate, making buying stock on margin much less attractive. As fewer people bought, stock prices fell, removing the incentive for new buyers to purchase the stocks bought by earlier buyers on margin. Many investors were forced to sell at a loss by margin calls, which are calls by brokers for investors to bring the cash in their margin accounts up to a certain level after the value of their stocks had fallen. The panic was on as investors rushed to dump their stocks for whatever they could get for them. In effect, the stock market crashed overnight. People withdrew their savings from the banks and foreigners withdrew their gold, which further depleted the reserves on which the money stock was built. From 1929 to 1933, the money stock fell by a third, and a third of the nation's banks closed their doors. Strong said privately that the problem could easily be corrected by adding money to the shrinking money supply, but unfortunately for the country, he died suddenly without passing this bit of wisdom on. It was dramatic evidence of the dangers of delegating the power to control the money supply to a single autocratic head of an autonomous agency, the Federal Reserve, and this process and procedure is still in effect. A vicious cycle of debt wound up dragging all in its path into hunger, poverty, and despair. Little money was available to buy goods, so workers got laid off. Small-town bankers like George Bailey from the movie were lucky if they escaped bankruptcy, but the big banks made out quite well. Many wealthy insiders also did quite well, quietly pulling out of the stock market just before the crash, then jumping back in when they could buy up companies for pennies on the dollar. While small investors were going under and jumping from windows, the big money boys were accumulating the stocks that had been sold at distressed prices and the real estate that had been mortgaged to buy the stocks. The country's wealth was systematically being transferred from the great American middle class to big money. Another important point, the homestead laws were established in the days of Abraham Lincoln to encourage settlers to move on to the land and develop it. The country had been built by these homesteaders who staked out their plots of land, farmed them, and defended them. That was the basis of capitalism and the American dream, the level playing field, on which the players all had a fair start and something to work with. The field was level until the country was swept by depression, when homes and farms that had been in the family since the Civil War or the Revolution even were sucked up in a cyclone of debt and delivered into the hands of the banks and financial elite. So what we see from this is that the Federal Reserve scheme had failed. But Congress did not shut down the shell game and prosecute the perpetrators. Once again, this is the 1930s version, but if we look at what is happening on Wall Street today, for example, through the movie documentary Inside Job, nothing has changed. It's only gotten worse. Well, back in the 30s, the response to this was the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, the FDIC, was instituted apparently to prevent the Great Depression from ever happening again. It would do this by having the federal government provide backup money to cover bank failures, furnishing a form of insurance for the banks at the expense of the taxpayers. The FDIC was prepared to rescue some banks, but not all. It was designed to favor rich and powerful banks. Ed Griffin writes in the book, The Creature from Jekyll Island, quote, "The FDIC has three options when bailing out an insolvent bank. The first is called a payoff. It involves simply paying off the insured depositors, those with deposits under $100,000, and then letting the banks fall to the mercy of the liquidators. This is the option usually chosen for small banks with no political clout. The second possibility is called a sell-off, and it involves making arrangements for a larger bank to assume all the real assets and liabilities of the failing bank. Banking services are uninterrupted, and aside from a change in name, most customers are unaware of the transaction. This option is generally selected for small and medium banks. In both a payoff and a sell-off, the FDIC takes over the bad loans of the failed bank and supplies the money to pay back the insured depositors. The third option is called a bailout. Irvin Sprague, a former director of the FDIC, explains, "In a bailout, the bank does not close and everyone, insured or not, is fully protected. Such privileged treatment is accorded by FDIC only rarely to an elect few." That's the end of the quote from Mr. Griffin. The elect few are, of course, the wealthy and powerful banks that are considered too big to fail without doing irreparable harm to the community. Believe it or not, that exact phrase which we're hearing today was used then. In a bailout, the FDIC covers all of the bank's deposits, even those over $100,000. Wealthy investors, including wealthy foreign investors, are fully protected. Continuing, Griffin observes, quote, "Favoritism toward the large banks is obvious at many levels. The large banks get a whopping free ride when they are bailed out. Their uninsured accounts are paid by FDIC, and the cost of that benefit is passed to the smaller banks and to the taxpayer. This is not an oversight. Part of the plan at Jekyll Island was to give a competitive edge to the large banks." End of quote. And as an aside, for anyone who is interested, it's a lot more complex, but it is a very interesting book. Read the book, The Creature from Jekyll Island by Ed Griffin. I recommend it. Well, the FDIC shielded the bankers both from losses to themselves and from prosecution for the losses of others. Later, we'll see the International Monetary Fund was devised to serve the same backup function when whole countries defaulted. Austerity measures and belt tightening were imposed on the poor, while welfare was provided for the rich, saving the moneyed class from the consequences of their own risky investments. This is really an ironic twist, and it is not only horrible, most people do not even conceive of the fact that through this process, welfare is going to the wealthy. If you're just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. So in looking back to the 1930s, who was to blame for this decade-long cycle of debt and devastation? Milton Friedman, professor of economics at the University of Chicago and winner of a Nobel Prize in economics, stated, quote, "The Federal Reserve definitely caused the Great Depression by contracting the amount of currency in circulation by one-third from 1929 to 1933. End of quote. The Honorable Louis T. McFadden, chairman of the House Banking and Currency Committee, went further. He charged, quote, "The Depression was not accidental. It was a carefully contrived occurrence. The international bankers sought to bring about a condition of despair here so that they might emerge as rulers of us all." End quote. Representative McFadden was a controversial figure, but he could not be accused of partisan politics. He had been elected by the citizens of Pennsylvania on both the Democratic and Republican tickets, and he had served as chairman of the Banking and Currency Committee for more than 10 years, putting him in a position to speak with authority on the vast ramifications of the gigantic private credit monopoly of the Federal Reserve. In 1934, he filed a petition for articles of impeachment against the Federal Reserve Board, charging fraud, conspiracy, unlawful conversion, and treason. He told Congress, quote, "This evil institution has impoverished and ruined the people of these United States, has bankrupted itself, and has practically bankrupted our government. It has done this through the defects of the law under which it operates, through the maladministration of that law by the Fed, and through the corrupt practices of the moneyed vultures who control it. From the Atlantic to the Pacific, our country has been ravaged and laid waste by the evil practices of the Fed and the interests which control them. At no time in our history has the general welfare of the people been at a lower level or the minds of the people so full of despair. Recently, in one of our states, 60,000 dwelling houses and farms were brought under the hammer in a single day. 71,000 houses and farms in Oakland County, Michigan, were sold and their erstwhile owners dispossessed. The people who have thus been driven out are the wastage of the Fed. They are the victims of the Fed. Their children are the new slaves of the auction blocks in the revival of the institution of human slavery." End of quote. A document called the Banker's Manifesto of 1934 added weight to these charges. An update of the Banker's Manifesto of 1892, it was reportedly published in the Civil Servants Yearbook in January 1934 and in the New American in February of 1934, and it was circulated privately among leading bankers. It read in part, quote, "Capital must protect itself in every way, through combination, monopoly, and through legislation. Debts must be collected and loans and mortgages foreclosed as soon as possible. When through a process of law, the common people have lost their homes, they will be more tractable and more easily governed by the strong arm of the law applied by the central power of wealth under control of leading financiers. People without homes will not quarrel with their leaders. This is well known among our principal men now engaged in forming an imperialism of capital to govern the world." End of quote. That was the sinister view of the Great Depression. The charitable explanation was that the Fed had simply misjudged. Whatever had happened, the monetary policy of that day had clearly failed. Change was in the wind. Over 2,000 schemes for monetary reform were advanced, and populist organizations again developed large followings. Now, nearly four decades after he had led the March on Washington, Jacob Coxey reappeared on the scene to run on the former Labor Party ticket for president. Coxey, who was nothing if not persistent, actually ran for office 13 times between 1894 and 1936. He was elected only twice as mayor of Massillon, Ohio in 1932 and 1933, but he did succeed in winning a majority in the Ohio presidential primary in 1932. Franklin Roosevelt came from banking and railroad money and had the support of big business along with the general public. He easily won the presidential election, but Coxey maintained that it was his own plan for government-financed public works that was the blueprint for the New Deal, the program widely credited with pulling the country out of the Depression. It was the same plan Coxey had proposed in the 1890s. Congress could jumpstart the economy by priming the pump with various public projects that would put the unemployed to work using government-issued, debt-free money to pay for the labor and materials. Roosevelt adopted the pump-priming part, but unfortunately, not the proposal to finance it with debt-free greenbacks. A bill called the Thomas Amendment was passed during his tenure that actually authorized new issues of government greenbacks, but no greenbacks were issued under it. Instead, Roosevelt financed the New Deal with deficit spending and tax increases. In 1944, Coxey was honored for his work by being allowed to deliver a speech on the Capitol steps with the formal blessing of the Vice President and the Speaker of the House. It was the same speech he had been barred from giving there half a century before. In 1946, at the age of 92, he published a new plan to avoid unemployment and future wars. He died in 1951 at the age of 97. Another example of aging populists returning was a blast from the past on the presidential campaign trail for William Hope Harvey, author of Coyne's Financial School and economic advisor to William Jennings Bryan in the 1890s. Harvey ran for president in 1932 on the Liberty Party ticket. Like Coxey, he was an obscure candidate who was later lost to history, but his insights would prove to be prophetic. Harvey stressed that people who took out loans at a bank were not actually borrowing money. They were borrowing debt, and the commercial oligarchy to whom it was owed would eventually end up running the country. The workers would live on credit and buy at the company store, becoming wage slaves who owned nothing of their own. Harvey considered money to be a direct representation of a man's labor, and usury and debt to be a scheme to put middlemen bankers between a man's labor and his property. Even efficient farmers operating on the debt money system would eventually have some bad years and some would default on their loans. Every year, there would be a certain number of foreclosures, and the banks would get the land, which would be sold to the larger farm owners. The country's property would thus gradually become concentrated in fewer and fewer hands. The farms, factories, and businesses would wind up owned by a few individuals and corporations that were controlled by the bankers who controlled the money supply. At the heart of this problem, said Harvey, was the Federal Reserve System, which allowed banks to issue debt and pretend it was money. This sleight of hand was what had allowed the bankers to slowly foreclose on the country, moving ownership to the Wall Street banks, brokerage houses, and insurance companies. The ultimate culprit was the English banking system, which had infected and corrupted America's banking system. It was the English who had first demonetized silver in 1816 and who had decreased the value of everything else by hoarding gold. Debts to the English banks had to be paid in gold, and countries that did not produce gold had to buy it to pay their debts to England. The result was to drive down the value of the goods those countries did produce, indenturing them to the English bankers, in order to place the reins of the country in the hands of his worldwide banking system. And we will continue in the next show. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life and Debt, your debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me at lifeanddebt@gmail.com. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous debt manageable life.